This is Kelly Prager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Glenn Blankenship. Today is 14 February 2013. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Blankenship is joining me by telephone from his home in Florence, Kentucky. Mr. Blankenship, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some background biographical information from you, if I may. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
Okay, I was born March 26, 1944. In Torquay, Devon, England.
And what were your parents' names?
My father's name was William Blankenship, and my mother's name, I'll use her nickname, Nancy Blankenship. Her legal name is Annie Susie Alice, and she just detested that her whole life, so everybody called her Nancy.
Well, I can certainly understand. That's a mouthful. Now, what did your parents do for a living?
Well, when I was born, Dad was a sergeant in the Canadian Army. Mom, she was... Oh, she worked at a department store and was also a bus conductress, and at night she was an air raid warden.
So your father was in the Canadian Army during the Second World War. Is this why he was in England, I would assume?
That is correct, yes.
And your mother was she native to England?
Yes.
Okay, I see. And they met there, I guess, during their time, or during his time there in England?
That is correct, in 1942.
1942. Okay, so he had been in England for a while then.
1939.
Since 1939. Oh, okay, terrific. Now, do you know anything about your father's military experience there at the Canadian Army?
Yes, I do.
Well, tell me about that a little bit.
Well, this is probably going to cause you a little bit of, this can't be, but... My family history is a little convoluted. I'll start it by saying that the original family name is Adkins. Dad was born Glenn Adkins. In 1939, Dad changed his name to William Blankenship and joined the Canadian Army. Now, Dad was born in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So Dad changed his name, went up to Canada, and joined the Canadian Army under the name William Blankenship.
Now, why did he leave the U.S. to join the Canadian Army?
We'd all like to know that. You'd ask Dad, and he'd just give a little crooked smile on that. Would be that. But I don't know. And Dad stayed with the Canadian Army for 6 years throughout the war. You know, he didn't transfer to American forces at all, so there must have been something there that kept him.
Yeah, I guess so. Very interesting. Now, what was your father doing in the war?
Dad was in Royal Canadian Engineers, and then... he got hurt, I believe, and transferred to the Royal Canadian Medical Corps.
And what was his role there?
He did physical therapy for troops, you know, that had been injured. But Dad, he was at Dunkirk.
Okay.
And after that, he also went back to France at during the raid at Dieppe, if you're familiar with that. I don't know if you know anything about that.
Yes, I'm passingly familiar with it, yes.
Okay, well, Dad was part of that fiasco. And something happened, and he got transferred into the medical corps, and that's how he ended the war. He didn't go back to France again. He said he'd been there twice, and that was enough.
Yeah, I would, under those circumstances, I would certainly understand that. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had two sisters. One was killed about 25, 30 years ago. Another one is still alive.
Okay. So, born in England, where did you grow up?
Canada.
You grew up in Canada. And where did you grow up in Canada?
Toronto.
Okay. Well, tell me about growing up in Toronto in the 1940s and the 1950s. What was that like for you?
Well, you're really taxing. You know, I was just, of course, just real young then. I remember cold and a lot of snow. But little memories come back. I can recall ice being delivered with horse-drawn carts at that time. You know, memories come back, and I can remember people would make their living sharpening knives and scissors and going around with little hand carts. And growing up, you know, it was a peaceful, quiet time.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing seemed to be wrong in the world.
Certainly a different version of Toronto than what we're accustomed to nowadays. For sure.
Yes, yes. You know, of course, you got to realize at the end of World War II, you know, I don't know if they were still using horse-drawn carts, you know, to some extent in the States or not. Probably were, you know, for delivering milk and things.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably the early 1950s, they went the way of the covered wagon.
What sort of things did you like to do as a kid growing up there?
You know, probably like all kids, you know, just playing outdoors. And you talk hockey, you know, as soon as the first freeze came, you know, and the pond would freeze up, you know, you'd strap on the skates and out you'd go.
Right. What about school? How well did you do in school?
You know, mediocre. Never was a very good scholar.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that being raised in Canada during this time, of course, in a global sense, the dominant feature of global activity, of course, was the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union and the two competing blocs of power and things like that. Growing up in Canada, what did you see and what did you know about the Cold War? What was your perspective on it up there?
You know, some of the memories are very, very vague. You know, I can remember we had the duck and cover up there too.
Okay.
What to do in case of a nuclear attack. I can remember, again, very, very vaguely, little radio snippets in that from the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember hearing or reading about, you know, the French defeated the Dien Phu, which, you know, I think, you know, where's Vietnam? What is that? What is a Dien Phu? You know?
Mm-hmm.
But I can just vaguely remember that.
Mm-hmm. Now, growing up during the Cold War in Canada, was military service something for sure that you were going to embrace, or was it something that you didn't have to necessarily get involved in? What was the situation there for a young man growing up?
Well, you know, everybody had pride of country,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's a lot different today. It just seems to be there's a select few that have that. But, and I'll preface a few things, in this time frame, we also moved back to England, and I went to school over in England for a while. You know, so I've shuttled mm-hmm. around quite a bit. But when I was in high school in Canada, we were living in Port Hope, Ontario at the time. When I was in high school, I joined the Cadet Corps, which, you know, you got a Army uniform and got trained by Army personnel and that, and got the feel cool. And then when I was old enough, I joined the Canadian Militia, which is like the National Guard. I spent a while in that, and then when I was old enough, I joined the Canadian Army. I was 17, went into the Canadian Army.
Now, had you graduated high school prior to this?
No, I hadn't.
Okay. Now, the Canadian Army, as it was at that time, explain for me the kind of the structure of the environment that you were in. What were you going to be doing? What units were you involved in? What was it like to be in the Canadian Army at that time?
Well, I know that it was a lot stricter than the American Army. I mean, discipline was really strict. Mm-hmm. But I think the esprit de corps was a lot higher than in the American Army. I took my basic training out at Edmonton, Alberta. And from there, I went into Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry and spent my time as a infantryman. And when my time was up, the family had moved again from Canada down to the States, so I came down to the States.
How many years did you spend in the Canadian Army?
Three.
3 years. Okay. And was this something that was it a positive experience for you, maturing experience for you? How would you describe your time there?
I think it was positive in that it gave me a lot of disciplines that helped me in my situation in Southeast Asia.
Okay. When did you and your family move to the United States? Do you remember the year?
Yeah, I got my discharge, I think it was in 63, and then I came down to the States. Mm-hmm. His mom and dad were already down here.
Okay. And why did they move back to the, or why did they move to the United States?
I'll have to say I don't know. Moved around a lot, and they're, you know, never did seem to be a explanation for it. I just kind of went along because that's the way things were.
Mm-hmm. Now, did they move to Tennessee where your father was from?
No, moved to Monroe, Ohio.
Okay.
And Dad purchased a Sunoco gas station there.
Mm-hmm. So having been in the Canadian Army, as well as school in Canada and school in Great Britain, what was it like for you as a young man in his early 20s to move to the United States?
You know, to me it was just a different locale to party. You know, be brutally honest, you know, I wasn't looking at political philosophies or anything like that.
Sure.
I knew that the beer was a lot weaker.
Well, there is that. What did you want to do when you came to the States? You've already had your hitch in the Canadian Army behind you now. You're coming to the United States. You have family here. What did you hope to do as a young man in the United States?
You know, just be with family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I came down and I helped Dad run the gas station. And I really didn't have any aspirations beyond that.
Now, again, I'm going to ask you to draw on your background as a Canadian. When you come to the United States, you're looking at 64, into that era. How aware were you of what was going on in Southeast Asia? How aware were you of the level of effort of what was going on between the United States and the countries in Southeast Asia?
Know anything about it.
Is that right?
You know, it wasn't reported on,
mm-hmm.
other than, you know, little snippets here and there, but, you know, nobody paid much attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
at that time.
You eventually, obviously, get involved in with the United States Army. You're going to be an American soldier in Vietnam. Do you? Can you tell me how that happened? It seems, again, kind of unique, I think.
Okay, well, first off, I'll say that I was lied to. Okay? After I'd been down, I went through all the legal processes, and I became a legal resident. I tried to get American citizenship through my father, but I couldn't do that. And backtrack just a little bit. When an American citizen joins a foreign military, they automatically lose their American citizenship. So when Dad joined the Canadian Army in 1939, he lost his American citizenship. Now, in 1946, Congress passed an act that if an American had enlisted with an allied military force, they just had to apply and they would automatically get their citizenship back. Mm-hmm. So Dad did this. He became an American citizen again. But that didn't help me because I was born in 1944.
Right.
So I couldn't become a citizen through Dad. So I simply did the process of becoming a registered alien. Mm-hmm. And got my green card.
Okay.
Got my green card, and I was advised that I would have to register for the draft. So I did. I registered for the draft. A little bit of trepidation, but they said, no, you don't have to worry. You served with an allied military. You won't get drafted. I said, okay. So, registered for the draft, went down to take my physical, getting a little more concerned, and again they said, you don't have to worry, this is just a formality. Okay. Well, they lied to me because about 3 weeks after my physical, I got my induction papers into the Yankee Army.
What? How did you feel about this, Mr. Blankenship? What was your reaction to this?
Maybe here's another challenge in life. I don't know. Let's give it a whirl, because that time Vietnam was starting to come into the fore. Mm-hmm. And, let's give this a try. It can't be anything worse than what I went through before. So I had a choice. I did not have to be inducted. I could have simply walked across the border.
Mm-hmm.
Legally.
Right.
They could not stop me. But I couldn't have come back to the States again. And I guess it wasn't me to do something like that, to run.
Mm-hmm. What was your family's reaction to this? How'd they feel about it?
I don't think they were very happy with the situation, being as that both Mom and Dad had experienced a lot of stuff in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any inclination to look at the legal aspects of this and see if you could avoid service in the United States Army since you'd already served in the Canadian Army?
I made a few inquiries, but there was nothing to be done about it.
Hmm.
But a little side note on this, there was a family friend, kind of the same situation, where their son got drafted, and he was half Indian from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And Indians in Canada come under the protection of the Queen. So they petitioned the Queen to get him out of the draft.
Huh.
I don't know what happened, but he never got drafted.
I'll be darned. That's really interesting. Now, you make the decision to not go back to Canada, which, of course, you had every legal right to do. So you're going to join the United States Army. Tell me about the process of being inducted into the Army and boot camp. Where did you attend boot camp? Tell me about your early days in the Army.
Drafted, received orders to report to, the federal building in downtown Cincinnati. And there I got on a bus and went down to Fort Knox and took my basic training in Fort Knox.
Mm-hmm. After having been through all of this in the Canadian Army, what was it like for you in the American Army? What was boot camp like for you?
The DIs were miserable people. They tried to make your life a living hell. But I'd been through it before and just simply went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess knowing how far to push the system helps.
Expand on that for me a little bit. What do you mean by that?
Knowing what you can do and what you can't do, what you can get away with, how you can non-verbally disagree with what an NCO is saying without causing repercussions.
Right.
Well, and how to get out of work.
Mm-hmm. What types of work did you want to avoid?
And anything that caused you hard labor and sweat. Of course, that was a little difficult in basic training because they followed you pretty closely.
I'm sure that they did. Well, you have a unique perspective here, having gone through basic training in both armies. Can you compare and contrast the two?
No comparison. The basic training in the Canadian Army was longer and a lot more detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot more disciplined.
Now, did you find that to be disappointing in the American Army, having been through what you're saying is perhaps a little more structured, a little more disciplined kind of background in Canada?
No, it made things a little easier for me.
Mm-hmm. What kind of specific differences did you find?
I guess Just the simple fact that the NCOs didn't ride us as hard in the American Army as they did in the Canadian Army. We weren't pushed as hard.
Mm-hmm. What month did you finish up, if you remember, basic training there at Fort Knox?
Let's see. Drafted July 21st, so it's been mid-September. I finished basic training at Fort Knox.
And this is 1964.
That's 65.
Okay, 65 by this time. Okay.
Yeah, I was drafted in 65.
All right. Now, by this time, the American involvement in Vietnam is beginning to ramp up. Is that on your radar? Do you see that coming on your horizon at all?
Yes, I can distinctly remember one day at Fort Knox, we were all herded into a non-air-conditioned classroom for another lecture on something, and I happened to look down at the desk that I was sitting at, and somebody had carved into the desk, "You're going to die in Vietnam, boy." I said, doesn't sound good.
That's an eye-opener, I would say.
Yeah. After all these years remembering that.
Hmm. Well, you finish up in basic training in, I believe you said it was September of 65. What did you hope to do in the United States Army? Was there a particular branch that you wanted to go into, a particular part of the service? Are you interested in to become a combat engineer? Are you interested in engineering? Are you interested in medical field or one of the combat arms? What did you hope to do at this point?
You had no choice in the matter.
Mm-hmm.
They picked it for you.
Okay.
I guess if they found out that you'd been a blacksmith in civilian life, they would make you a cook. You know, I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. I guess because I'd worked at with my father at the gas station, that they said, well, he'd make a good mechanic. So that's what they put me in as.
Mm-hmm. So you'll undergo a further training here. Where was the next step?
Fort Carson, Colorado.
Okay.
And there I was attached, or at least, excuse me, I was with the 7th Combat Engineers.
Describe for me your time at Fort Carson. What are you going to be doing? What was the environment like, et cetera?
It was a great time. Colorado's just a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
It was great duty. Normally, after basic training, you go through what's called AIT,
mm-hmm.
Advanced Individual Training. For some reason, I didn't have that. They just sent me out to Colorado, and next thing I know, I'm looking at a tank, and they said, well, you're going to be taking care of this. That was the first time in my life I'd ever seen a tank.
Well, after all, you did have all that great experience pumping gas in your dad's gas station.
So oh, yeah.
You got to know
yeah.
how to operate.
That's Evans, yes. So, you know, I got on-the-job training, OJT, as they say, in becoming a tank mechanic. And I also took a course out there as a combat engineer. And so I basically had two MOSs, a combat engineer and a tank mechanic.
I wonder if you might explain both of these in a little bit more detail. How do you become a tank mechanic? You said you'd never seen one before in your life. How do you go about learning how to work on these things? They're incredibly complex.
Oh, they are. Just day by day, you know, you're out there learning to do different things on it. And, you know, how to change tracks, you know, the maintenance on them, how to make sure that the weapons inside are working, how to pull an engine out and put a new engine in, you know.
What about as a combat engineer?
It was very cursory training, but it was enough for them to enter it into my records. You know, how to run a minesweeper, how to dig mines up, how to blow things up, how to put up bridges, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that you had any sort of natural facility for these types of things, whether it was being a mechanic on a tank or working with combat engineers and these various things you'd be doing? Did it come to you naturally?
Yeah, I didn't have any problems doing it.
It
didn't seem to require a great deal of brain work.
Mm-hmm. Well, where do you go when your time is up at Fort Carson?
Oh, you mean when I'm finished on duty at Fort Carson, or
yes.
After I'm done at Fort Carson?
Well, when you're done with your duty there at Fort Carson, I should ask you this. How long did you spend at Fort Carson?
I was there from September... So I'd say probably April
mm-hmm.
of 66.
Okay. And where's your next step after that?
Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
All right. Now, what will you be doing in Fort Bragg?
I was with the 14th Combat Engineers.
Okay.
But go back just a little bit.
Sure, sure.
While I was with the 7th, Combat Engineers in Fort Carson, I came down on orders, I think, three times for Vietnam.
Hmm.
But because I was not a citizen, I couldn't go because they hadn't investigated my background thoroughly. So I know in talking to some of my friends when I came home on leave and with mom and dad that the FBI came by two or three times asking people about me.
Hmm.
Well, again, I didn't think I was going to go to Vietnam. I got to the orderly room of the 14th Combat Engineers, and I walked in, and there on the wall was a huge map of Vietnam. And I knew there and then I was screwed.
What were you going to be doing at Fort Bragg? Is it just further training in combat engineers?
Well, when I got to the 14th, you know, they'd been deployed, I think it was twice, to go to Vietnam, but they couldn't go because they were just so horribly understrength in personnel and equipment. So when I got there, they were in the process of building the battalion up to deploy. So they only had about 25% of the personnel when I got there, and maybe 15-20% of the equipment that was needed, you know, to deploy.
Right. So they're pretty severely under strength then.
Correct.
Yeah. So how long would it take before they became full strength, or at least full enough strength to?
Well, we deployed in September of 66.
Okay. Now, when you are deploying to Vietnam, you're getting your orders, and you mentioned that they'd come up before, but you weren't going at that point. What was your initial reaction to this? I mean, you didn't think you were going to have to serve, and you didn't think you were going to have to go to Vietnam. And now both of these things have come to pass. What was your reaction when you knew for certain that you were going to go to Vietnam?
I guess, you know, a little bit of excitement. Yeah, I've never been to a place like this, never fought in a war before.
Mm-hmm.
And also a little bit of trepidation. You know, what have I put myself into?
How about your family?
I know mom and dad were, it bothered them an awful lot.
Mm-hmm. Had you been following what was going on in Vietnam up to this point? Once you kind of figured that, like you said, when you got to Fort Bragg, you knew that you were going to be going. Did you start to pay more attention to what was going on, whether it was news broadcasts in the evening or reading newspapers or following the news of what was going on in Vietnam?
Yeah, we were following it pretty closely at that point because we were getting what they considered the best training available for soldiers going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Well, you chuckle when you say that. Can you explain why?
Have you ever seen the movie The Green Berets, John Wayne?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, one of the things we did, we helped build that Vietnamese village.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was one of our training tasks. We helped build that. And the training that we got, once we got over there, we realized that they didn't know what they were talking about.
Hmm.
I remember we had one little lecture on what to do if you're driving in a convoy and you get ambushed, and what they said you're supposed to do, that if you're driving a vehicle and you're not incapacitated, i.e. meaning shot, drive your vehicle directly at the source of the fire. And I thought, this doesn't sound right. You're supposed to be getting away from it, not going towards it. And, of course, the people that said that had never been in the roads over in Vietnam.
That was what I was going to mention. It's one thing to say that, but in practice in Vietnam, depending on where you are, that could be an impossibility with the roads the way they were and the terrain the way that it was.
Hmm. Pretty much.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you were paying attention to what's going on in Vietnam. What about the overall role for the United States being there? Is this something that you bought into, thought, well, this is... United States is doing the right thing here? Did you question whether the United States should have been there?
Didn't think about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess it boiled down to the common denominator, you know, how is this going to affect me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't worry about right or wrong or, you know, what caused it. All you know is that you are going to get involved in it, and what can I do to make this a little easier for myself?
Mm-hmm. When do you receive your orders for Vietnam?
When did I receive them?
Yes, sir.
Oh, when I walked into the orderly room of the 14th Combat Engineers.
Okay, so you knew at that time it was going to happen.
Yeah,
regardless.
I didn't get individual orders because the whole battalion was deploying.
Yeah, the unit itself was going over, just a matter of getting up to full strength. Okay.
That is correct.
All right. So you know you're going. You have some trepidation, but some excitement, like you said. Your family, obviously, your mother and father aren't real crazy about this, having been through the Second World War. That's obviously a very difficult thing for them to do. Can you tell me about the day that you left for Vietnam? Was your family there with you? Did they see you off? Tell me about that scene.
I believe it was about 2 weeks before we left for Vietnam. Everybody got leave to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And there was about four or five of us that lived in the Cincinnati area, I'd say, and we rented a car in Fayetteville and drove up, you know, to Greater Cincinnati, and then met by family members and spent the time, and then reassembled and drove back to Fort Bragg. And the reason I remember that is that one of the people in the vehicle was my old platoon sergeant, Sergeant Young, who I met at the VA last year, which is an interesting story in itself.
That seems to be very interesting. We certainly want to touch on that before we finish the interview.
But when we talk about Sergeant Young, please bear in mind that he is not the one that shot the elephant. I want to make that.
Right. Another story that we'll get to.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I can remember, you know, going out with friends and partying and everybody wishing me well and saying, thank God it's him, not me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm glad I'm not drafted.
Right.
And then, you know, we drove back, you know, to Fort Bragg. Do you want to know how the battalion left for Vietnam?
Yeah, please tell me about that. I think that'd be interesting.
Okay. By that time, of course, we had a full complement of men and equipment. So we loaded heavy equipment, bulldozers and that. And I say we didn't have a single tank, even though I was a tank mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to Fort Bragg, and I kept looking for the tanks, and said, well, we don't have any, but that's okay. Don't worry about it. We loaded the equipment, heavy equipment, on rail, and the vehicles, we drove to Charlotte, and from there, we, you know, they were loaded on a ship. We went back to Fort Bragg by buses, and from there, everybody assembled, and we went to, I believe it was Pope Airfield there at Fort Bragg, and we flew out to California, to San Francisco. Again, if I remember, it was like in the dead of the night, you know, we landed, and they herded us onto buses, and buses went to the Oakland Army Pier,
mm-hmm.
where we boarded a troop ship. USNS General William Weigel.
Okay. Now, this is another one of these new experiences for you, I would assume, boarding a troop ship and sailing across the Pacific Ocean. You're not going to get there in a day like many of the people who did, who went over as individuals to begin their tour. You're going over as a unit, and you have a lot of equipment that has to go over there as well. Describe for me what it's like to sail across the Pacific to Vietnam on a troop ship.
Boring and miserable. The air conditioning broke down, you know, about 2 days out. It was a three-week trip.
Mm-hmm.
The air conditioning broke down. Buckets were placed in the hallways for those who came down with seasickness.
Were you one of them?
No. I crossed the Atlantic two or three times, by passenger ship, you know, so I was an old salt.
Right.
But a lot of fellows were deathly seasick. And it was just boring. I mean, I had KP every other day, and that was the only break in the monotony.
Hmm. What sort of things do you do on a troop ship for 3 weeks when you're not on duty?
You know, you just hang out with your buddies. Some fellows gambled. You know, there was a lot of money won and lost on that trip, from what I understand. But I've never gambled.
Mm-hmm.
It made limited, the library had limited resources, so, you know, you'd get a book and read it and read it and read it. Or, you know, in the morning you get out and look at the left side of the ocean, and then in the afternoon switch over and look at the other side of the ocean. Then at nighttime you could go and look at the stars.
What were the facilities like there on the ship? Was, I assume, crowded, multi-layer bunks, that sort of thing?
Yes, I think it was like six high bunks. Odd numbers inhale, even numbers exhale. It was miserable.
Yeah. Well, after this 3 weeks, where do you come into Vietnam?
The first stop was down at Vung Tau, mm-hmm. and there was an infantry battalion. They got off at Vung Tau, and then we went up to Cam Ranh Bay, and I was in A Company, and A Company and Headquarters Company disembarked at Cam Ranh Bay, and there the boat went up north, and the rest of the battalion got off. Vung Tau, I think it was. I'm not sure where they got off, because I kind of worried about my own little thing at
sure.
that point.
Sure. So you're off in Cam Ranh Bay, and this is an incredibly busy seaport. I mean, it's hustle bustle. There's things coming in. There are things going out. It's an incredible place of embarkation, the way I have it pictured in my mind. Give me your initial impressions of Cam Ranh Bay.
Well, actually, you know, Vung Tau was the busiest. I can remember seeing cargo ships upon cargo ships just waiting to go in to get unloaded in Vung Tau. There weren't that many in Cam Ranh at that point, because it hadn't really, it was just in the process of being opened up, because even the airfield wasn't quite finished at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But we disembarked by landing craft. You know, we went down the side of the ship on landing nets,
mm-hmm.
you know, those rope ladders.
Right.
You know, and this was terrifying. You know, we'd never done it, never trained for this at all. Climbing down the net and into the landing craft where you couldn't see anything. We were not given any ammunition, which is probably a good thing at that point. And we'd all seen all the John Wayne movies, so we knew what happened when that landing craft hit the beach. So we were wondering, how are we going to accomplish this with no ammunition? And I can distinctly remember feeling the sand scraping on the bottom of the landing craft, and then the ramp slamming down onto the beach, and there was a line of buses waiting for us, and a big sign said, "Welcome 14th Combat Engineers to Vietnam." I thought, well, this isn't so bad. You know, so we got on the buses. We asked the driver, why did they have, you know, wire mesh on the windows? And he said, oh, don't worry about that. we're very naive at that point.
Right. Did you figure out why it was on there eventually?
Oh, yes, yes. And then we got to some temporary quarters. You mentioned the equipment. At this point, we had zero equipment because the boat with all our equipment on it was broke down and in the Panama Canal.
Hmm.
So we had nothing other than what we carried with us.
Yeah.
And that was the case for about 3 weeks or more.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So what are you doing in the meantime here at Cameron Bay?
I guess they just found make work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we were part of the 18th Engineer Brigade, so I would assume that, you know, the officers got together and they found equipment that we could use, like shovels and picks and things like that, and wheelbarrows,
right.
Hammers. But it was a good time there in Cameron Bay. They built an EM club, and we had semi-cold beer. We could go swimming in the South China Sea. I thought, this is pretty good. I was getting a nice tan. You know, hey, you know, I can take this. But then the equipment came in and got sent down south, and it all changed.
I'm sure of that. I wondered, during these weeks here at Cameron Bay, did you have the opportunity to engage any of the Vietnamese, whether they're civilians or military personnel at this point?
No. No, not at all. We're pretty much isolated.
Yeah. All right, the equipment comes in, and real work is about ready to begin. Pick up the story there. Where do you go?
Well, you know, the equipment comes in, and, you know, the orders start getting issued and that, and I find out that I have been attached to 2nd Platoon, who is being deployed down south to Phan Chiet and attached to the 2nd and 7th Cavalry.
Hmm.
So we loaded our equipment onto an LST and went down south.
Okay, once you're there, what happens next? You're going to obviously unload the equipment off the LST. And these LSTs are big boats, of course.
Yes.
You unload your equipment off the LST. Where are you going to be set up? Where are you going to be headquartered out of?
Well, the LZ there at Phan Chiet was LZ Betty, and we were outside of the actual LZ itself. We were kind of on our lonesome on the top of a hill looking down at the beach. If you looked at the pictures in the website, if you saw an explosion, we'd blown up some VC tunnels.
Mm-hmm, right.
And where those tunnels were, I was looking down at them from our compound.
Yes, I'm looking at some of the photos right now. It really is pretty striking when you see these photographs. Okay, now describe this place for me. What was the layout there? How large was it? How were the quarters set up? Things like that. Describe the location for me.
It was just basic quarters, meant, you know, like frame sides with a tent roof on it. An awful lot of sandbag bunkers all around, which we spent a lot of time in. Mm-hmm. And just sand. God, it was miserable. Dirty all the time.
What is your unit going to be responsible for?
Combat engineer support to the 2nd and 7th Cavalry.
Mm-hmm. What did that consist of?
Sweeping roads, searching for booby traps, putting in bridges, replacing bridges that have been blown. If you see the pictures there of the bulldozer stuck in the mud,
mm-hmm.
that's a bridge that the VC blew, and we're in just demolishing it so that we can put a new one up.
How busy? What was the rate of activity there in terms of VC activity? How active were they there?
Pretty active.
Mm-hmm. Was it primarily booby traps and mining roads and blowing bridges, that kind of activity?
Yeah, you know, we weren't involved in, of course, engaging the enemy. You know, that was the infantry's job.
Right.
Our job was to make sure that everything was clear when they went in to engage the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Well, take me on a typical day, if you will, Mr. Blankenship, if there was such a thing as a typical day, from the time you got up, and of course it would depend on the day, it would depend on the circumstance, it would depend on all of these different factors, but say on an average day, what would you be doing?
Again, it just varied so much. You know, we never knew really from day to day. I mean, you could start out in the morning and, okay, we got to perform maintenance on these vehicles, and then an hour later, you know, to get that vehicle running and get out to LZ Betty. Mm-hmm. You know, they need something done there. There was really not a typical day, other than they were long.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let me approach this in a different way, then. Because like you said, it's so incredibly varied in the jobs that you would do. Let's say that there was a road that needed sweeping. Take me on one of these sweeping missions.
Okay. Again, we really didn't know where we were. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the pictures there, you'll see a picture of someone sweeping a road.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see it?
Yes, I'm looking at it.
Okay. More than likely, we were given an assignment someplace down that road. So there'd been an indication, I would suppose, that mines had been planted there.
Mm-hmm.
So we would sweep the road before we proceeded to where the job site was going to be.
Where would this intel come from, someone saying that we think this road may be mined? Where would that come down from?
That would probably come from my buddy Dennis Coyne.
Okay. And, of course, Dennis and I just finished up an interview last week.
That's what he did. You know, officers knew this stuff. And I have, I was at the very bottom of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing filtered down to us. We didn't know really what was going on most of the time, other than we were told to do this and go there. And where the intelligence would come from, you know, it wasn't shared with us.
Sure.
Which is and that was a good thing.
Right, it's a need-to-know kind of thing, and
correct.
It's not your job to be concerned about that sort of thing. Well, how many people would go out on a road-sweeping mission?
probably what you see there. You know, that there'd be a couple of fellows running the detector, you know, switching on and off, a couple of NCOs, and a few other fellows for support and security. And you have to realize that this was just the platoon. We were there by ourselves. You know, there's only about 30 of us.
Mm-hmm. What is it like for someone who has never operated a minesweeper or walked down one of these roads with a detector? What is it like to be holding that thing and walking down this road?
Well, first you say, I hope I don't pick up anything. Mm-hmm. And then you say, well, maybe it's better if I pick something up. Because sometimes they put stuff down there that isn't picked up. Mm-hmm. And then if you do get something, you hope it isn't what you think it is.
Right.
And it's a hell of a way to earn a living.
Yeah.
It just saps you of all emotion, you know, because all you're concentrating on is the sound coming out of the microphones. Excuse me, out of the earpieces.
I would assume that there was just a constant sense of anxiety when a person was doing it. Did you find that to be the case?
Yes, and really a constant sense of anxiety all the time, because you just, no matter what you were doing, because you never knew what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, we lost a few vehicles, you know, to mines. You know, you can't pick them all up.
Let's say you come across a mine in the road. What would be the procedure for you guys? What would you do once it's found?
You just dig very, very carefully to see what it is. Mm-hmm. And it could be nothing more than a sea ration can. You know, and they would bury metal objects haphazardly on a road, so you would just keep picking up these odd bits and pieces. And they figure, well, finally he's going to get tired, and by the time he gets to the good stuff, he won't be able to register it.
Mm-hmm.
Or he'll miss it.
Yeah.
But you find something and dig it up and see what it is and dispose of it. A lot of times they used artillery shells, you know, our own artillery shells. I guess they got them from Arvin. But they'd bury an artillery shell, like a 105 or 155, and take the fuse out and put a detonator in. And then if you set it off, you're setting off an artillery round.
Mm-hmm. And these would be pressure sensitive detonators, I would assume.
Yeah. Normally a pressure release.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mr. Blankenship, this is, I think, incredibly interesting stuff here. Say you found, for example, a 105 shell that had been buried in the road, and you dug it up, and you know that it's a 105 shell, and you're being very, very careful with this thing. What do you do from there? Are you going to, you dig it out, you pick it up, you move it, you blow it in place? What is the process for dealing with this mine once you found it?
Dig around it very, very carefully, particularly around the nose, mm-hmm. you know, just where they've got the fuse, to see if it's linked to anything else. There's another wire running off someplace else. And just dig around it as much as safely possible, if that's the term you can use when handling something like that. And once you figure out what it is, you know, the NCOs would try to, you know, make a drawing of it. take back to an intelligence officer somewhere, and then just simply blow it in place, either with TNT or C4.
Okay. You perhaps pack C4 around it and then deck cord and then safe distance.
Blow it, correct.
Yeah, you blow it. Okay. All right. Now,
then you get to go and fill the hole in.
Yes. Yeah, that's the other part of it, huh? Now, did the VC bury these? Were their methods the same? Were they very routine in the way they did them? Did it depend on the VC who was burying them on how they would put these things together? For instance, if they were going to string them or wire them to another one, you know, say 50 feet down the road, were they pretty standard in how they would do it, or did you have to figure them out each time depending on how it looked?
You know, I can't recall. I guess because when my team came, you know, to do it, you're just so focused on taking care of that one that you just take care of it and you're gone.
Right.
You know, but Charlie was good. Mm-hmm. He was very good.
Now, you mentioned the artillery shells, and this is something that we hear pretty regularly about the American shells that were duds or that they were stolen from someone else or whatever it might be. And you mentioned that they could possibly come from the Arvin. About the 105s, the artillery shells, were there different kinds of mines that they would place in addition to the artillery shells?
Yeah, you know, sometimes it would just be a large amount of explosives, or you know, a lot of times they had a lot of Chi-Com stuff that they'd use, you know, mines. A lot of bouncing Bettys, that's what we feared. Are you familiar with them?
Yes, I am. Now, there's mines and then booby traps, and obviously people don't want people to be confused that they're the same thing, because they're not necessarily.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Tell me about the...
Bouncing Betty is a mine, but it's an anti-personnel mine.
Yeah.
Versus an anti-vehicle.
Tell me about finding these types of booby traps. I mean, describe for someone who's not familiar with what a Bouncing Betty was or is, explain what that is and explain how you would go about dealing with these when you encounter them.
Well, a Bouncing Betty is, well, we have to thank the German Wehrmacht for that. They developed it in the Second World War. The Bouncing Betty is an anti-personnel device that you trigger it, and a small explosion blows it waist high, where it detonates and it's filled with ball bearings, and it's meant to either castrate or disembowel you.
A lot of the ground troops that I've talked to over the years have described the Bouncing Betty as being the most feared type of booby trap for that very reason. Now, how would these be triggered?
Usually by a pressure, or a trip wire. Mm-hmm. So they could run a trip wire through the foliage.
Right. Well, that's something I think that is also just incredibly interesting and a very difficult thing to do, I would imagine, is finding these trip wires. Like you say, you're talking about people who are hot, people who are oftentimes very tired, perhaps not as focused as they might be when they first wake up in the morning after doing all this all day, and going through dense foliage from time to time. These trip wires are obviously very, very thin pieces of wire that are used to trigger the detonation of say, a Bouncing Betty. How were you trained, and how effective was this training on discovering trip wires?
Mostly OJT. You got to bear in mind, again, that wasn't my primary job.
Mm-hmm.
I would just be thrown in when they needed some extra help doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Training, just talking to fellows that had done it. You know, and then they'd advise you, this this is what you want to look for, this is what you want to be careful of.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of those specific things that they would tell you?
Yeah, if you're unfortunate enough to hit the trip wire, if there's enough time, if you turn backwards and throw yourself on the ground. So if you could throw yourself on the ground, you might get by.
Mm-hmm.
So when it blows, it just blows over you, or maybe, you know, you get hit in the back a little bit, or maybe some in the buttocks. That's if your luck holds.
Right. Now, did you ever see any of these go off?
Yes.
Do you care to talk about that?
No, not right now. No.
Okay, that's fine. I understand. Well, let me switch gears here a little bit, Mr. Blankenship. You've talked about going down and clearing roads for mines and booby traps. What about duty with bridges? You mentioned that there are VC are out there sabotaging these bridges, blowing these bridges. What would it be like once a bridge is blown? What would the standard operating procedure be? Is the whole platoon going out? Is it just a squad out of the platoon going out, depending on the size of the bridge, et cetera? How would it work when a bridge was blown?
Usually just the squad would go out. And, of course, you know, the NCOs would have gone out beforehand. Assess the situation that this is what we need, and go out and demolish what was left, and then put up a new one using timber.
And who would be responsible for providing the timber? Was it something that they were purchasing from the native Vietnamese? Was it something that the Americans had a stockpile of? Where would it come from?
It would come in by LST. We'd get just huge bulks of lumber, quadruple soaked in creosote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the stuff would get on you, and you know, you handle these things all day long, and you're just covered in creosote. And the only way to get it off was using diesel fuel and very limited water to wash with.
Mm. That had to have taken a toll on your skin, on your body. I mean, the creosote is bad enough, obviously, and you're handling these timbers, but to have to wash it off with diesel fuel, this is a bad combination. How did that affect you?
You just felt miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wish the EPA had been over there. I think they could have come out with a regulation that would have helped.
I'm sure they would come up with at least one.
Yeah.
So on these bridge details, or for lack of a better word, if the bridge has been blown, the bridge is mangled, I'm assuming you're going to have to bring in probably bulldozers and things to clear out the old bridge, the damage from the old bridge.
Correct.
And then start the new bridge completely anew. Is that the way that it would work?
That is correct.
Now, you are a trained tank mechanic, as you mentioned. You're not someone who is necessarily trained to go out and find mines. And I'm assuming equally that you're not someone who is trained to build bridges.
That's correct. But all you were needed for in that instant was a strong back and a weak mind.
Yes. That's what I was getting to.
In the engineers, there's the phrase that you use when you're working real hard to move a piece of equipment. It's lay, hold, heave. and they still use that today, you know, and that's it. You get a huge piece of timber and just lay hold, heave.
Now, with all of this incredibly strenuous activity for something such as this, whether you're digging holes or you're clearing a bridge or putting up timbers for another bridge, or even the minesweeping operations, we also have to remind the listener to this interview that you're also looking at about 100 degrees, 95 to 100 degrees, depending, and high humidity. That may have been a little bit different since you were closer to the coast, I guess. But what kind of physical toll does the climate, the geography, and the work have on your body?
I remember just being tired all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because after you're done working, you've got guard duty. You know, maybe every other night you have to pull guard. You know, so you're physically tired. You're mentally tired.
Mm-hmm.
And you're dirty. You're never clean.
Yeah.
And you're always running out of things that they never find replacements for.
That's a great topic. What sort of things would you run out of that you really needed to have?
Well, I'll give you a good example. I got a picture of it somewhere. We had a low boy trailer that we transported our dozers on,
mm-hmm.
and it ran over a mine, and it blew the right rear axle completely off. And there was not an axle or another set of wheels to be found in all of Vietnam.
Hmm.
So we figured what to do, so I came up with the idea. I said, well, let's just, we jacked the axle up and put a huge chain around it and secured that big chain with some wire so it wouldn't come apart, and we ran that trailer with three wheels.
I've actually been a part of something like that in vastly different circumstances, of course. Yeah, I can see in my mind exactly how that would have worked, actually. Huh.
And, you know, maybe later on, but there's as I found out in talking with Sergeant Young, there's another story within a story about that trailer. And so it was good running into him.
Well, do you care to relate that story? Not necessarily Sergeant Young running into him, but the story within the story about the trailer?
Yeah. We left Fanchiette, and we went back to Cameron Bay because our battalion headquarters was in Cameron Bay. It stayed there the whole time we was over there. Boy, they had it made. But we had to go back to Cameron Bay and kind of get our equipment taken care of and then head on to our next assignment. Well, I guess this trailer was there in the compound, and the colonel came around inspecting because I guess there was an IG inspection or something the next day or two.
Mm-hmm.
And Don said that the colonel came up to him and just chewed his ass out for this trailer, looking like it did, with only three wheels when it should have four, and told him to get it fixed immediately. And there was just no parts for it.
Mm-hmm.
So Don went around Cameron Bay trying to find parts, and he ended up at some signal outfit, and he was ushered into the office of this major, and he explained the situation, and the major said, well, we can both help each other here, Sergeant. He said, we're having an inspection soon as well, and we've got two trailers, but we're only supposed to have one. And this is where my memory comes in, because I can remember having this almost brand new trailer come in, and I was told, sand these numbers off of it and put ours on it. Okay. So I sanded the numbers of that signal outfit off, and I put our numbers, and I put the number of the trailer of the one that only had three wheels on, and that was driven off someplace and thrown off the side of the road.
The Army does have its ways of dealing with these things.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was a win-win situation for everybody.
Now, you mentioned that this lowboy trailer had the back axle on the right side blown off. Now, was this a road that was supposed to have been cleared by your outfit? Was supposed to be cleared by someone else's outfit?
I don't recall.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you that, and this may be a difficult question for you, but was there ever a time when you or your unit, for example, swept a road and said, look, it's clear, or we got everything out of it, and this road is clear now, and then turns out that there was something buried deeper that your sensors didn't pick up, that there was an explosion? Did that ever happen, or did you know of that ever happening?
Yeah, that happened.
Mm-hmm. In an instance like that, would there be repercussions for the individual or the unit responsible, or would powers that be look at it and say, look, these things are going to happen, we try to avoid them when we can, but we just understand that that's part of it? How would that work?
No, I don't know. The repercussions would be the poor bastard that hit the mine.
Yeah. Yeah. How long would your days last there? How long would you be working on duty?
12 hours a day, normally, 6 days a week, and we only work 8 hours a day on Sunday.
Only 8 hours a day on Sunday.
That's not including guard duty.
Right. So your routine is very, very full. It's basically a daylight to dusk kind of thing. And from what I hear you saying, you're working on this until you're assigned to do something else. And it may be a very rapid transition. Like you say, maybe you're fixing some equipment, then all of a sudden you're called off, like you said, to LZ Betty to work on something there. And I know that you mentioned in your questionnaire that you work quite a bit all around 2 Corps, I believe you said. So this is, again, 12 hours a day. Then you come back in the evening. Once you come back in the evening, what is your routine? What sort of things do you do when you come back?
Yeah, first thing is grab a shower if there's any water left. Go eat. And, you know, if you don't have guard duty, you know, you can hang out with your buddies and BS and that. If you got guard duty, you just trot on off to wherever your assigned position is.
Mm-hmm. Just around the perimeter, I would guess.
Two perimeters. We'd either pull guard on our own perimeter, or there's rotation where we would pull outer perimeter guard for the 2nd and 7th.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of taking your turn, I guess, essentially, as it was assigned.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned taking a shower or not taking a shower, and you mentioned getting some chow. What were the facilities there at Van Thiet like for things such as, you know, for showers, for mess hall, et cetera? What were the facilities like?
Well, the shower, the unit before us, they had built a shower stall, which was nothing but timber frames with 55-gallon drums on the top of it. So what you would do during, it, you know, someone that would get the job first thing in the morning, they'd go and fill these drums up. I think there's probably about 3 or 4 of them. Fill them up with water, and during the day, you know, the sun would heat the water up, and they were placed end on end.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be a hole knocked in the bottom of the barrel with a wooden bung. So you'd go in and you'd pull the bung out real quick, get wet, stick the bung back up, lather yourself up, and then again pull the bung out and rinse off as quickly as you could, because you didn't want to use all the water.
Sure.
If you used all the water, the fellow behind you would get mad.
Mm-hmm. What about the mess facilities?
I beg your pardon?
The mess facilities. What were the facilities like where you ate? What kind of foods were you receiving, etc.?
You know, there was a mess hall there again. It was like a tent with wooden sides on it. And, you know, the food, they did the best they could. But, you know, if you're out in the bush, I mean, you don't have the mess hall. You know, you've got the ubiquitous sea rations. I was at a reunion, like I go to a reunion once a year with my buddies, and we were just talking this last reunion. But things we remembered in that. And one fellow said, you know, I remember being hungry all the time.
Hmm.
I said, yeah, you know, you never seem to get enough to eat. because you're expending a tremendous amount of calories just in the sheer physical aspect of your job.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And sometimes there just wasn't quite enough food.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned being out in the bush. Were there times when you would be out all night or more than one night?
Yes, a few times.
Can you describe those for me, if you remember them?
You know, first off, it's the silence. Mm-hmm. You know, and the darkness, because, you know, you don't have, you know, the bright city lights, and you don't have traffic noises. You know, you don't have radios blaring, you know. But then as you start becoming accustomed to it, you hear all the little noises that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, animals rustling and things crawling around. And you're hoping you're not hearing something that you don't want to hear.
Right. Now, on one of these times when you would be out for an entire night, or perhaps more than one night, who provides security? Are you providing your own security?
It depends on what we're doing in that. You know, sometimes security would be provided by the infantry unit we were with.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we provided our own, and it just depends upon what the mission is.
Yeah. How would you, for instance, set up a night defensive perimeter when you were out there? Say if security was left up to your unit.
I I'm going from knowledge gleaned after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
We just went where we were told.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, this is where you're going to be. You three fellows get in this hole, and you know, if anything happens, you know, sing out. But from what I've read in my studies afterwards, that, you know, these were set up in a very precise manner. You know, it wasn't just holes that were haphazardly dug out there. I mean, they were set up so that, you know, there was covering fire and crossfire.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you? You mentioned the darkness and the quiet, but if you're out there in a hole providing security for that shift or for that entire evening or whatever it might have been, what's it like to be out there? I mean, you have to be vigilant. You have to be awake. This is after a hard day of doing your work as a combat engineer, whether it's building a bridge or whatever it might be. What is it like to be in that foxhole providing security for the rest of the unit at night? Again, this is not something you're necessarily trained in doing.
No. Well, first off, it's keeping awake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you're so bloody tired. You know? And listening, you know, and watching, you know, for anything out of the norm. And in fact, I'll throw another name out here. I have a nephew that's in the British Army, Sergeant Brett Campbell with the 4th Rifles. I got to throw him in because I'm proud of the boy.
Sure.
Did a tour in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we talked before he went to Iraq, before he became extremely skilled at what he does, and he asked me for some pointers, and I told him, I said, well, one of the first things you want to do when you go out on guard that night, count everything in front of you, look at all the bushes and see where they are, because at 2 o'clock in the morning, they will get up and start to walk.
Hmm.
You know, and that's it. I mean, you can hallucinate. You're so vigilant and so tired. One of the worst things that happened to me when I was out like that, I heard a tiger make a kill. This is when we're up in the Central Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, it's just dead silent. You know, I guess all the little critters knew that a tiger was around. So they'd just gone to ground immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume this was like a small deer or something that the tiger got. But I heard the scream of the deer or whatever it was when the tiger got it. I remember hearing the roar of the tiger, just letting everybody know, hey, I just killed this and it's mine. And then listening to it eat. and I'm terrified. I said, God, you know, what if he got a taste for American? And there were a few soldiers that were killed by tigers on guard duty over mm-hmm. in Nam.
Yeah, I've certainly heard about those. How close was this tiger to you? If you could hear him so close that you could hear the deer screaming and him eating, he must have been pretty close.
Oh, I figure he's probably a couple of foot in front of me at least.
Oh, really?
it's just hard telling.
Yeah.
It's hard telling, you know, and come morning, you know, I wasn't curious to go out looking.
I'm sure. Well, that is very interesting, and it takes us probably to a good place to stop here for today, Mr. Blankenship.
Hey, I can't believe it's, you know, I really didn't think I had that much of a story to tell.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Glenn Blankenship. Today is 19 February 2013. I'm in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Blankenship is kind enough to join me by telephone from his home in Florence, Kentucky. Okay, Mr. Blankenship, you're talking before we turn the recorder on about moving up from Fan Thiet and attaching yourself or being attached to part of the 101st. So pick up the story there, please.
We had to, our job was to put an airfield in for an operation that the 101st was going to conduct. We got to the area, and we were, from what we were told, the first Westerners to be in that part of Vietnam since the French pulled out.
Hmm.
And as usual, we went in and secured the area before the infantry came in. We worked on the airfield, got it complete, and the airfield was one of we made with PSP, pierced steel planking. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am, but could you describe what a PSP is for someone who might not be familiar with it?
It's long sheets of steel that have holes in it. And it's kind of like putting maybe a Lego set together. Mm. It's all interlocking. You just simply slide the locks in place and then bang on it with a sledgehammer to lock it in. You know, and of course you have a level ground that you put it on. That ground has to be leveled.
And how would, I think this is really interesting here. Can you just take me through the entire process from what you remember about building an airstrip? I mean, this can be pretty complicated work. From the ground up, what did the area look like? What kind of actions did you have to take to level the ground? What kind of equipment's being used? Give me the whole rundown of this. I think it's very interesting.
I know it had to be very complicated, and you have to bear in mind that I was merely forced labor. I wasn't there
sure.
handling the mathematics of it. But of course, they would send a team in and survey the area, find the best location, and then simply go about leveling the ground, with bulldozers. And once you got the ground level, you would lay the PSP down. And when that was laid, then the first plane would land, and it would have the communications gear, you know, everything that the Air Force needed, you know, to control the flights in and out of the area.
And, of course, you're talking air traffic control to some measure.
Correct.
Not like we would understand it today, but the principle is still the same. So I'm assuming there's a tower that's going to have to be built as well.
You know, I don't think I recall off the tower. I think they set themselves up on a small hill.
Okay. Well, what is your job? You mentioned laying the PSP, and like you mentioned last time, the strong back and weak mind swinging a sledgehammer and locking the PSP into place. Right. What other sorts of things would be involved in setting up this?
Well, of course, it's just the manual labor of hauling, the PSP out to the area, and pretty much everything was done manually. And then, of course, there was maintenance on the vehicle and pulling security, because we were down in a little valley. Fortunately, at that time, I didn't know anything about the Indian food, so I wasn't really worried about being in a little valley in South Vietnam.
Ignorance is bliss in that case.
Yes. But, we put the airfield in, and the Air Force came in, set up their control, and they started flying supplies in. The 101st came in and secured the area for us, so we felt well protected once they arrived.
Sure. Now, laying this PSP, about how heavy would one of these particular sheets of PSP be? What would it weigh?
I'm thinking that they're probably maybe 6-7 foot long. Two and a half, 3 foot wide, maybe a little wider. The weight of them, gosh, maybe 80 pounds, something like that. I could go online. I'll go online and see what they say about that.
Oh, that's not necessary for sure. I was just kind of wanting to give the listener some idea of the size and the weight of these things. It's going to require a lot of them, hundreds of them, I would assume, and probably many more than that. Thousands of them.
Yes.
And what kind of work, if one or two people handling these things, just to kind of give you an idea of what kind of physical activity would be involved in this.
Yeah, it's pretty much drudgery, putting it. But then again, it has to be done properly, because you don't want a plane to land and blow a tire or something.
Sure, sure. How long did it take from the time that the bulldozers show up to level off the land, to the time that the first plane lands? How long did it take to set it up?
I'm going to have to give a guesstimate here, because a lot of things are really foggy. Just moved around so much, in one spot and then moving to another, and doing different jobs. But I'd say a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was leveled, and then another week or two in getting the PSP laid. But on a little interesting side note, a few years back, I was sitting in an establishment drinking an adult beverage and just started talking to the fella, and he said he'd been over in and asked him what he did. Said, "Well, you combat engineer." We kind of swapped a few stories, and he said, "Yeah, I had this one god-awful job. We had to go to this airfield that was up in the central highlands." He said it hadn't been used in a couple of years, and we had to rip up all the PSP to use again. I said, "Damn, I put that airfield in."
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Huh.
It's a small world.
I would guess so. You mentioned that the 101st came in after, when they could be brought in, after probably a couple of weeks or so. It makes me wonder, what kind of relationship did you guys as combat engineers have with the infantry units or the airborne units, et cetera? What kind of relationship did you guys have with them?
We didn't fight.
That's one thing.
They didn't like us. We were legs.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We didn't jump out of airplanes. They looked upon us with contempt, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, airborne is kind of known to do that to the non-airborne types, I think.
That is true.
Well, how long did you stay up here at this airfield?
You know, I'm thinking about 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Things are a little foggy because of moving around so much, and you know, I've looked at my records, and they show me as being back down in Fantiette for part of the time, so it's a little confusing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And we're also looking at 40 some odd years intervening.
Correct.
There as well. And we certainly understand that. Well, where did you go once the airfield was complete? Do you remember that?
Yeah, when the airfield was complete, we went down south onto the coast at a place called Ninwa, and there we supplied support for the first Korean division, the White Horse Division, I believe they were called.
What was your impression of the Koreans?
Glad that they were on our side.
I hear that quite a bit. Can you explain why?
Maybe kind of like we were talking about before the interview started, that they had a little different concept of how things should be done.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay without getting too explicit?
If you don't care to get any more explicit, that's fine. That's absolutely fine for sure. You know, the Koreans were certainly known for being very aggressive, is certainly one way to put it.
And excellent interrogators.
Yes, that's another one that I often forget about. That's right. That's right.
But that was really done there. It was just kind of mundane duty, building roads, bridges. You know, really, it wasn't a very exciting time in Ninwa, which is a good thing.
Sure.
Because. And we had, the Koreans pulling security for us.
And probably felt pretty secure about that as well.
Extremely.
Yeah, yeah. Any idea how long you spent there on the coast?
I think I got there maybe May. And then I went home the end of July.
Mm-hmm. So you spent the rest of your tour there at Ninwa?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Well, that brings up another series of questions. Now, everybody, of course, or most everybody, is going to get an R&R period. Did you get a chance to go on R&R while you were there?
Yes, I did.
And where'd you go?
Tokyo.
Tokyo. Why Tokyo?
That's what was open.
That's the one that was available and you took it?
Yeah.
All right. Tell me about what it's like to be a young man in Tokyo, leaving the war temporarily for an R&R in Tokyo. What was that like?
Well, now, this is an excellent story that you've never heard before.
Good.
I went on R&R with my good friend Nikolai Tarkin, passed away last year from Agent Orange.
Hmm.
But Nick was Russian. He was born in Bremen, Germany in 1946. So I'm assuming that his family was either forced workers, prisoners of some kind of the Germans. And Nick was Russian Orthodox in his religion. Well, we got to Tokyo, and but the second day we come back to the hotel, and there's a note for Nick that his brother is in Tokyo from New Jersey looking for him.
Hmm.
So Nick called the hotel up where his brother was staying, and he wasn't there. And he said, well, I know where he'll be. And apparently this was some kind of a high holy day in the Russian Orthodox religion. So we find the only Russian Orthodox church in Tokyo, and we get a cab to take us there. And lo and behold, there's his brother in the church. So, you know, stayed for the service in that. Then, of course, we had to be introduced to the priest. And then also the bishop of the Russian Orthodox Church in Japan was in town. Bishop Vladimir. Never forget that. We got invited to a party at the priest's house. So we sat down and were drinking vodka. Lots of vodka. There's myself, Nick's brother, the Russian Orthodox priest, and the Russian Orthodox bishop. Well, halfway through, in walks a Japanese Catholic priest. And he's got a bottle of bourbon that was given to him by an American pilot. So we commenced on that. So I spent the evening getting drunk with a bishop.
That has the makings of a good joke.
Yeah, well, I'll never forget it because he looked Russian, like a Russian priest would be, you know, bishop. You know, the big bushy beard and everything, and he sat beside me, and of course, he was getting very drunk, and he kept kissing me on the cheek. And then when Nick and I staggered to leave, he blessed both of us, which I'm not a very religious person, but that was a touching thing that he did.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But that's my R&R in Tokyo.
Hmm. Now, were there any other activities you got involved in, going down to the Ginza or seeing any of the sights or anything like that?
Yes. Enjoyed some Japanese food. Had a good time.
Mm-hmm. About when in your tour did you make this R&R?
This was in January of 67.
Okay, so you're about halfway through your tour there, I guess.
Correct.
When you got this, something like that. All right. Now, I know that there was another episode that you mentioned to me last time. It has to do with Sergeant Young, and I think there's an elephant involved. Would you mind relating that story to me?
Yeah. When we were up in the Central Highlands, and I hope I run into Sergeant Young again very soon because I want to tell him that this is going to be down in posterity. But he claims no knowledge of him being involved in this. But apparently when we're up in the Central Highlands, the natives up there, the mountain yards, they used elephants a lot, you know, as beasts of burden. Mm-hmm. Well, the story is, supposedly, that some sergeant got drunk and shot one of the elephants. It made Stars and Stripes. There was an article in Stars and Stripes about it because the Army flew a veterinarian in from Saigon to treat this poor wounded elephant that had been attacked so cowardly by the VC. Now, Sergeant Young says it wasn't him because the elephant was shot with an M16 and all he carried was a 45, and we weren't issued M16s. All we had was M14s. So he's standing by that story.
I would too. But it seems that you have a little bit of skepticism about that.
Yeah, but, you know, it's his story and he's allowed to say what he wants.
So because this elephant was attacked by the Viet Cong, there were no repercussions for the American who may or may not have been involved in it.
Sergeant Young left with his stripes. So.
Now, you're staying here at this place with the Koreans to the end of your tour. Now, do you know I'm assuming you're aware that the clock is ticking on your tour. The second you get to Vietnam, the clock is ticking on your tour.
Correct.
And you're there, I believe, what, from like May to July, I believe you said.
Correct.
67. May of 66 to July of 66.
No, May of 67.
May of 67.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Are you one of the people who was counting down the time, how much time you had left in country, or you just kind of put that out of your mind?
Oh, I'm counting it down.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Does that include a short timer's calendar, as they call them?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a short timer stick every day. I cut off a piece of it until there was nothing left, and the day there was nothing left was the day I was on the Freedom Bird.
I'd like to know, does it give you any sort of comfort when you're whittling away at this short-timer stick as it gets shorter? When do you start to feel good about the time that you have left? Or do you feel good about the time that you have left?
I don't think you feel good, because as time gets shorter, you get more apprehensive.
And that's what I was hoping you'd talk about. Tell me about that. How does this apprehension manifest itself?
You become, for me anyway, you just became more cautious, became too cautious.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think when you first get there, you're just too dumb to be cautious. And then after you've been there a while, you know what it takes in order, you know, to keep yourself in a secure situation. And then when you get down to going close to home, you just become overly cautious, which is not a good thing.
Yeah. Do you care to elaborate on that a little bit? What sort of things would you do that, as you look back on it, you see that perhaps you were a little too cautious?
Just you know, be extra careful where you went. If you're out on the road, just be hyper-vigilant, even more than you normally would, and just suspicious of everybody. You know, non-allied military personnel.
Yeah. What kind of contact did you have with the Vietnamese, the non-military Vietnamese there?
Not too much. You know, sometimes, you know, get a pass, go down the village, you know, that's pretty much it.
Yeah. What was your opinion of the Vietnamese? Not necessarily military forces, the ARVN or anything, but what was your opinion of the Vietnamese themselves?
You know, it's difficult, you know, to say. You know, and a lot of my compatriots have a lot of different views.
Mm-hmm.
As for me, I just thought, boy, they're different.
Mm-hmm.
My mom would yell at me if I did that in the house.
Sure. Well, while we're on the topic, what was your opinion of the South Vietnamese military forces?
Well, we figured that the first thing they were taught in basic was how to throw their rifle down and run.
Mm-hmm. Did you have much contact with the ARVN?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What was the nature of this contact?
Normally, you know, we'd be out on a job and we'd either run into them or they'd be providing some kind of support for us.
Mm-hmm.
Just didn't feel comfortable when they were out there.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted the Koreans back.
Sure. So the ARVN would perhaps be providing security, something like that?
That's what we were told, yes.
That's what you were told, right. Well, what kind of things, when you think about, when you look back on your time there in Vietnam, whether it was at Phan Thiet or wherever it was, what kind of cultural things do you hold on to as an American/Canadian? I mean, what kind of music comes to mind when you think about it? What sort of news stories come to mind when you think about your time there in Vietnam?
What sort of news stories?
News stories or music or movies or anything like that kind of comes to mind?
Well, I guess I remember, you know, several songs by the Lovin' Spoonfuls.
Mm-hmm.
because, you know, they were just coming into prominence. You know, they had a short career, but, you know, occasionally some, you know, a tape would come over with one of their new songs on it, and I can remember a few of them. But, you know, it may be diverse a little bit here, but my true music love is the son of Lubbock, Texas.
Yes. The icon out here, Buddy Holly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I listen to his music all the time.
Yeah.
Still.
What about the Armed Forces Radio of Vietnam? Did you have this going on in the background, whether you're out working or whether you're back at base camp?
You know, sometimes I can't recall listening to it very much. First of all, you know, it was getting a radio, and secondly, a lot of the places we were at, we just didn't get reception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, now, short timer, the time is winding down day after day. When do you know that you're getting your orders to go home?
When do I know? Well, I could probably dig around. I think I have some papers on that, but, you know, maybe about 2 weeks before it's time to go, you know, you get your orders and tells you, you know, when you go to the quartermaster and turn all your stuff in, where you report, you know, for the flight down to Cameron, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, take me through the process of leaving Vietnam. What day are you leaving? What's the process? How do you get down to Cameron? Take me through the process of coming home.
I believe it went by truck down to Cameron. There's, excuse me, several of us that were going home. Went down by truck to Cameron. Went through the cattle call and showed all our paperwork. We're given our flight assignment and told, you know, we'd be flying out, you know, the next day. So one day I'm in Vietnam. The next I'm down in Cameron putting on my set of khakis. With the brass was all covered in mildew, and the khakis were all wrinkled. And got on a plane, and next day I was back in the States.
Hmm.
Really, almost a two-day process from leaving Vietnam to landing in the States, and then one more day of getting discharged from the Army.
What was the atmosphere like on that plane when you left Cameron Bay?
Quiet. You know, it just... Once the wheels left the ground, you knew that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you knew that you were on your way home.
Can you describe that feeling?
Relief. Just knowing that the drudgery and everything was over.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be able to be clean again and have your fill of hot food.
Yeah.
And cold beer.
Sure.
Not necessarily in that order.
Right. Where do you come back into the United States? Where do you come into?
Fort Lewis, Washington.
Fort Lewis, Washington. Okay, describe the process there in Fort Lewis. You mentioned that you're discharged almost immediately afterward. Describe that process for me.
You know, we land there, you know, and then, you know, we're driven to the base and put up in barracks. And then the next morning, the process starts. The first thing that they did was run us through a pay line where we were given, I forget it was how much it was, like $26 or something like that. And what is this for? And I said, well, that's per diem. And I didn't understand what that was. So it explained, said, well, this is for the fact that you flew over, and for a day you were deprived of adequate rest, adequate food. And I said, damn, that's what I've been doing for a whole year. So after that, we went and got measured for a new set of greens. Went through the medical out-processing.
How thorough was that medical out-processing?
Very cursory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you appeared to have all your parts and you weren't bleeding and had no nasty rashes on your body, you were deemed healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, we got a steak dinner. Steak dinner with all the cold milk we could drink.
Was that something that you missed? Cold milk?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And this was provided by the U.S. Army then?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was in a mess hall.
Mm-hmm.
It did get a steak cooked any way you wanted it. That was good.
I bet it was. And the next day, you're out processed from the Army, you're discharged?
Yeah. The next day, given a plane ticket back home, and I forget what the time limit was on it, but we were told that we were allowed to wear the uniform for like 72 hours, and after that, it would be a violation of federal law, because we'd be impersonating a military person. Just stupid things like that stick in the mind.
Yeah. Well, what was the, when you got back home to see family, what was that reunion like?
It was good. But, you know, the one thing that sticks in my mind, Mom didn't recognize me when she first saw me.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And why was that?
A year without sleep, proper food, malaria.
So you had malaria while you were there as well?
Yeah. You know, and one thing that always sticks in my mind, went to sleep that night and Mom came in to kiss me and I jumped up and almost hit her. Mom's been gone a while now. That still bothers me to this day.
Sure, I'm sure. And that kind of speaks to a larger issue in that, and you mentioned this very briefly a little bit ago, that within roughly the period of 48 hours, you go from being in as a combat engineer in Vietnam to being released from the United States Army, living in the United States as a full-time civilian. I wonder if you could talk about your thoughts on the process, how it worked so quickly, leaving the war zone to coming back to civilian life.
You'll just be befuddled. You know, you don't know where you are, what to do. You know, you forget what the civilized norms are. You know, and I think that's why a lot of us that were over in Southeast Asia are screwed up today. You know, because of that, absolutely no transition. You know, they just simply cut you loose. You know, thanks for your 2 years of service. You know, don't wear the uniform or we'll charge you.
Hmm.
It was difficult.
Yeah. What was this transition like for you? You mentioned, of course, obviously, that this is a difficult transition. But again, in what ways did this manifest itself? Events or what sort of things happened shortly after you left the Army and are trying to adjust to civilian life? Were there any things that stand out in your mind in terms of how you were treated by the civilian? civilian personnel returning to the United States from the war, or, you know, opportunities for education or employment, anything like that?
No, well, I know when I landed in Chicago, you know, flew from Seattle to Chicago and then caught another flight. There was a bunch of people there, and they were throwing garbage at us.
Is that right?
Yeah.
At the airport in Chicago?
Yeah.
How did you respond to that?
Just couldn't quite believe. You know, it was disheartening, you know, when you consider, and the subsequent treatment by the country, both the government and the people of us. You know, we're most of just drafted. You know, we didn't want to go there. We did what the country asked, and then get treated like that. And it, I know that even, and they won't speak about it now, but veterans organizations really didn't want to have anything to do with us. They had to let us join because of their charter, and, you know, and we had the acquired medals, but they didn't really like us. I can remember being in the VFW with some of my friends that made, and trying to run for office, and every time we'd run for office, you know, the fellows from World War II and Korea would load the ballot box up with their friends, you know, and we, you know, for voting, and we'd never get in. Of course, that changed after a while when they started, the older fellows started dying off, and they realized they had to get somebody in. But yeah, it was difficult.
Yeah. Did you have any aspirations for further education, for employment, for a career? What did you hope to do once you were discharged from the Army?
I had no idea what I was going to do. I wandered an awful lot, wandered around the country, worked odd jobs, went back to England a few times. Can you turn the recorder off right now, please?
Sure. Okay, before we took the short break there, Mr. Blankenship, you're talking about your time coming back. You mentioned that you wandered around a little bit, had taken a couple of trips to England. When do you finally settle into a job or a career or a sense of normalcy, if you will, following the war?
Well, let's see. I was 21 when I got drafted. I was 23 when I got out, and I just wandered from, you know, job to job. Finally, I was 30 years old. I was working in a steel mill and got married and started having children. I guess that's when I became part of the American way of life. Or normalcy, I guess you'd call it.
Now, did you continue to keep up with what was going on in Vietnam? You're out in 67, of course, the war's going to go on for a number of more years. Do you keep up with what's going on in Vietnam at all?
Yes, I do. And as a little side note here, I mentioned my nephew, Sergeant Campbell, of the 4th Rifles in the British Army. He's had a couple of tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he sent me an email saying that he was feeling a little, I don't know the way that he described it. His recon section of his regiment was going back over to Afghanistan, and he elected not to go because he wanted to further his military career. He wanted to take another course. He's a career soldier. And he was telling me how he had mixed emotions about it. You know, his friends are going over and he's staying back. And I told him, I said, yeah, you know, I felt the same thing during the Tet Offensive of, you know, 1968. I knew then, you know, that my unit was pretty heavily engaged, and, you know, I wanted to be there. But as I told him, I wasn't stupid enough to re-enlist. I kept up with things, and when South Vietnam fell, that was a terrible time. I can remember watching the news and seeing the hordes of refugees coming out of the Central Highlands, coming down roads that I knew, that I had traveled very frequently. Very difficult.
Were you able to stay in touch at all with any of the members of your unit?
Not for a long time. And then as I started researching my claim for the VA, I found that the battalion had a website. So I went to that, and they had an association. So I contacted them and joined it. Started going to reunions and ran into fellows that I served with. So we meet once a year. And then, of course, running into Sergeant Young at the VA was a trip.
I wonder if you might explain that scene to me. What was that like for you?
Well, every Wednesday I go to meditation at the VA Center in Cincinnati. It helps me quite a bit. And one day a new member comes in. Big man. And goes around and says, hey, I'm Don. Yeah, hey, I'm Glenn. He goes around the table and introduces himself to everybody and goes and sits down. And we started chatting before, you know, things start. And he asked me, well, you know, where did you serve? And I told him, I said, you know, well, I was down in Fanchiette for a long time. I said, I was down in Fanchiette as well. Well, where'd you go from there? He said, well, from there, I went up into the Central Highlands and helped build an airfield. And I said, I helped build that airfield, too. And he said, well, who are you with? I said, the 14th Combat Engineers. He said, what company? I said, A. This is starting to get weird. He said, what platoon? I said, 2nd Platoon at headquarters. You're Blankenship, aren't you?
Really?
What's your last name? Young. I said, damn, Sergeant Young.
I'll be darned.
We jumped up and hugged each other.
I'll be darned. That's incredible.
It is. They said they've never seen that before. But it was a good thing. You know, one never knows. I spent a lot of time and research working my claim with the VA, and I acquired an awful lot of information and testimonials, you know, buddy letters and that about incidents. And I talked Don into, you know, applying, you know, to the VA, which he did, and he got compensation, and I'm glad that I helped him. But I loaned him, or I gave him, the letters that had written by fellows that we'd both served with, you know, to kind of help him jog his memory and help verify things. And he told me, he said, you know, for all these years, I've been having these nightmares, and I never knew where they came from until I read those letters. And that helped him. You know, he knew where they were coming from then.
Must have been incredibly powerful for him.
It was. it's one of those things. You know, we were leaving meditation one day, and we started talking out in the parking lot, and, you know, started to walk away to our cars, and he said, "Hey, wait a minute, Clint." And he walked up to me, and he grabbed my hand, and he said, "Thank you. You've done me good." That was emotional. That, you know, at that point, I forgave him for all the crappy details that he put me on. And I asked him why once. He said, "Well, someone had to do it."
Just as well be the Canadian, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, that was a good time, meeting him.
Yeah.
And it helped, you know, reinforce things that I could remember, you know, happening. You know, things we'd done that were just vague memories. I had this little memory of a truck being out of control, coming down the mountains out of the Central Highlands. And, you know, just one of these things you can barely remember. You know, there's something about the brakes weren't working on it. And Don was driving that truck. He said, "You know, I always remember, Glenn, you begged me not to get in that truck and drive it. You told me that the brakes were bad on it." And he ran into the side of the mountain to keep from going off the steep side of the mountain. But, you know, it was something I couldn't remember the details. And little things, you know, like that in talking to him come to mind.
Yeah.
And his denial of the elephant.
Right.
But we meet once a year. You know, this coming year, it's going to be in St. Louis. So we're all looking forward to getting together again.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I've got just a couple more questions for you, Mr. Blankenship. And they're questions that I ask everyone to kind of wrap up an interview. And they're broad questions, so please feel free to answer them however you see fit. The first is, as you look back on it, and this is the Vietnam War for so many people was a formative period in their lives. As you look back on it, how has your experiences, or how have your experiences most affected your life as a Vietnam veteran?
You know, people will ask me, "Well, how long were you in Vietnam?" And my answer is counting today. You know, I think things would have been a whole lot different if I hadn't gone. It changed my life completely. You know, a lot of missed opportunities because of the way I was after Vietnam. I don't know, it's a way I wish I hadn't gone, but others, you know, I'm glad that I went. I'd probably go again if I was asked. But, you know, this country has been real good to me. Like I told you, I'm a naturalized citizen. As we mentioned before, you know, I didn't have to go. Country's good to me, you know, and I feel, you know, maybe I owe this country one more fight. You know, if they asked me, I'd do it. Of course, I'd have to have my own corps of medics go with me to carry all my medicine and stuff.
Sure.
I Can I tell you how what made me decide to become an American citizen?
Please do.
I forget where we were at, but we were getting ready to leave the area, and we had some wounded with us. And we're getting ready to leave, and we came under fire. So the first thing everybody did, of course, was look for cover. Where can I go? And I looked, all except the medics. And they were laying on top of their men. You know, they weren't going to let them get hurt anymore. And I said, these Americans are pretty good. I want to be one. All right, it kind of chokes me up a bit.
That's all right.
So if, you know, hadn't been for Vietnam, God knows where I'd have ended up in this world. But now I'm here in the States. I'm an American citizen. I'm born in England. I've got ancestors that fought in the Revolutionary War against the English. I've got ancestors that fought for the Confederacy out of Kentucky. It's a long, strange trip from a boy from Devon, England.
Yeah. And I might also mention that, of course, you're involved with a charitable organization that does work in Vietnam. Another individual, a good friend of yours, Dennis Coyne, who we interviewed here not too long ago, is involved in this organization as well.
Yes, it's an orphanage up in the Central Highlands that's run by Catholic nuns, strictly for the Mountain Yard orphans. And the Mountain Yards are the indigenous people of the Central Highlands. We help train them, and then we abandon them, you know, to the tender mercies of the North Vietnamese communists. Oh yeah, Dennis, he's part of the board of directors, and all I do is write checks.
But nonetheless, that must serve a purpose of making you feel better about helping these people out after all the things that have happened over there.
Yeah. You know, I look at it as perhaps help repaying a debt that I owe. Whether I owe one or not, I don't know, but in my mind, I feel I do. Mm-hmm. So it does, it helps me. It's part of my healing process.
Yeah. Well, my final question for you today, Mr. Blankenship, again, a very broad, general one, but as we continue to look back at the Vietnam War, we're continuing to try to draw lessons from the Vietnam War. What does the Vietnam War mean for us? What sort of things should we learn, etc.? So let me put it to you as someone who was there, someone who on the ground is a combat engineer, someone who has certainly reflected on his experiences in the war in general, and as a student of history as you are, what do you think is the legacy of the Vietnam War?
Legacy? Gosh. Can I paraphrase my nephew?
Please.
Okay. When he was talking about not going back to Afghanistan and furthering his military career, his comment was, even though he had a lot of mixed emotions about it, he said, you know, there's not a single thing that me as a single person can do to change that bullshit war. maybe the same about Vietnam. You know, if we hadn't been there, what would have happened? Who knows? But you need to fight to win, and I don't think we've learned that. We talked a little bit before the recording started about different things, but you know, you need to go in and have the support of everybody and win. Do what it takes to win, and I don't think we had that in Vietnam. And I don't think we have it today. We're too concerned with niceties. But I know I went to a grocery store the other day. I love Oriental food, and I brought some stuff back, and I packaged in Vietnam. Oh, my God. So who won the war?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Blankenship, is there anything else you'd like to add before we put an end to the interview?
No, I've enjoyed this. I appreciate the way that you handled it, and not going into areas when it's indicated that I don't want to go. That's much appreciated.
Well, I appreciate that as well, and I certainly appreciate the time and effort that you put into this interview. We'll go ahead and put it to an end then.